The following program may contain content that your kids would love to hear, but you may not want them to.
You're an interesting species, an interesting mix. You're capable of such beautiful dreams and such horrible nightmares. You feel so lost, so cut off, so alone. No, you're not. See, in all our searching, the only thing we've found that makes the emptiness bearable is each other.
You're in the groove, Jackson.
It's time once again to be flabbergasted by the rolling tongue, the juggling of words, thoughts, and phrases, like a Spaniard on a tightrope. Here is the one, the only, the man of 2 hours, Frank Cottolo.
On my guitar.
This is a song about vegetables. They keep you regular. They're real good for you.
Call any vegetable. Call any. Call it by name. Call any vegetable. Call one today. Call when you get off a train. Call any vegetable. Call any vegetable. And the chances are good. All the vegetable will respond to you.
Some people don't go for prunes. I don't know. I've always found that if they...
Call any vegetable.
Call any vegetable.
Pick up your phone.
Call any vegetable.
Think of a vegetable.
Call any vegetable.
Chances are good that a vegetable will respond to you.
Rutabaga, 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 rutabaga.
A prune isn't really a vegetable. Cabbage is a vegetable.
No one will know. You don't want to let them know. No one will know unless it's you that might tell them so. Call and they'll come to you covered with dew. Vegetables dream of responding to you.
Standing there shiny and proud by your side. Holding your hand while the neighbors decide. Why is a vegetable something to hide?
Okay, here we go.
Listening to Frank Cottolo.
Okay.
was part of the world.
Operator, can I have Mr. Celery, please? Operator.
That's its control over there. You know what I mean?
This is the Celery family, please. Bard of Broadcasting, that's me, Frank Cotobo, the man whose name adorns the title of the show. Netarati, couple surfers, netaholics, and infomaniacs, don't go away, we're chronicling. Wake up, it is night. Somewhere on the planet, somewhere in your life. Time to replenish your precious bodily fluids. Heather Train is here, too. Right here at Y2K Plus 13 in May. Ice cap to ice cap, from hamlet to city, from Othello and into every bordello, all of which I believe are open. I think they're 24/7 bordellos, because nights to some people are days, days are nights. It's according to your schedule, and people do that stuff. They do that stuff. The bordellos are they? But you know, they're if they're illegal, then that's a whole other story. Let's not go there, because at least. The Othello and Bordello. Othello probably went to a Bordello. My name is Frank Cotobo, and the man whose name adorns the title of the show. The show is, of course, the chronicling of this time, the Hallelujah Trail time, the time of our lives. Oh, wow. I was on Talk Radio X the other day. I don't know if you got a chance to hear. A discussion that I had no idea would last an hour. I never know what hosts are going to throw at me. Talk Radio X. Coast to coast, global to global. What isn't global anymore anyway? We're all on here and you can get us anywhere. But the Talk Radio X Network goes far and wide. And here I am on it and talking. If you heard it, I'm glad you heard it, because I meant everything I said. And I'll say it again, only this time twice as loud. Time to replenish your precious bodily fluids. As I said, we got Heather Drain with us. I told you she was coming sometime, and she's finally put it together, the schedule. Her timing is perfect. We're going to talk about any number of pop culture things. She is an archive in her head of pop culture items, elements, movies, performers, artists, and large living and dead. And that's one of the reasons why in the collage at the beginning of the show, I have played the fabulous Mothers of Invention, and I think that it dawned on me while I'm listening to it, because I've always just heard the Mothers of Invention, the Mothers of Invention, and I remember because I was alive during that time, and I don't know if Frank Zappa, because I did not know Frank Zappa, if he decided to call them the Mothers of Invention based on the fact that that the whole pop world at that time, whether it was, you know, the classic serious pretentious rock, or it was pop rock or whatever rock, that it definitely needed to this particular type of craziness, which Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention were kind of like the Spike Jones and his City Slickers of the 60s. But I thought about for the first time was that called the Mothers of Invention. And, of course, that's from the phrase, necessity is the mother of invention. When you need something, someone will invent it. And I just a whole different spin on the name came to me. That's certainly, whether he thought of that consciously or not, it certainly makes sense to me. Because that was certainly a time when Frank Zappa came along with songs like Call Any Vegetable. And I was looking for one of my favorites. I couldn't find it. I don't know. I think it's on that big double album that I don't even know the names of these albums. Of course, Frank departed an angry soul because of many different things. I'm not going to get into that. But he was a great supporter of free speech, and I know that if he lived to see internet radio, he would have been on this show early on in the history of this show. We talked about that on Talk Radio X, how this show has been on for so long and how so many mainstream, I hate to use the term mainstream media, because I don't know, we are alternative. Don't think, when you hear that on your various news stations, when they say mainstream media, or you hear people like Sarah Palin saying mainstream media, all of it is mainstream media unless it's us. We are the true and only alternative radio. There's no other alternative radio. It's not like anything that isn't liberal is alternative or anything. It's not, doesn't work that way, see? Frank Zappa would have loved to have been here. So let's dedicate, and considering Heather is here, I'm going to talk about all these, I guess they're off the beaten track movies, publications. You know, there's still a great analog world going on out there, and you can merge with it, with your internet. That's all part of the Hallelujah Trail, how you merge. And a lot of the great spin-off underground stuff is still available. It's just not underground anymore. Everything's above ground. There's no more underground, per se, because of the internet. If there is, then it's on the internet. And I know this for a fact. I'll tell you why. Because when I was a part of the underground in publication and in certain broadcasting elements, areas, when I was part of the underground, I was still working on the overground, under an overground. There's not overground. I was still working in the mainstream. But the people I knew and the people I met from the underground, I swear to you, 9 out of 10 of them are on Facebook. So what's happened, and they do have their own websites, and they have their own, you know, artistic presentations and sights and sounds and music and whatever. So it's all one big show now. I said it was going to be that. That's what we said when we came on and when we signed on in the beginning of this great journey, which continues here with Cthulhu Chronicles. We've been chronicling this Hallelujah Trail from the beginning. That's what I was talking about on Radio Talk Radio X. Good place. I'm going to be back there. And I didn't know, you know, if I knew, it slipped my mind. And a good old Jiggy Jaguar was trying to get me on there, and then suddenly it came up, and I was on, and I didn't get a chance to promote it. I apologize to the Talk Radio X people. Tell them that I'll come on there. If you'd like to check out Talk Radio X, go ahead. And, you know, but make sure you also stay with SRN1. SRN Media Works is growing at biblical proportions, and we enjoy that. And we are helping to build this incredible station, which is now available. If you went to the blog this week, we have direct links on, and we have a whole nother a whole nother. It's not even a word. We have another stream going out just for the people who want to pick this up on Androids, iPhones, and Blackberries, and Blueberries, and Cranberries. And yes, yes, even grapefruits. So we're, but, you know, you can go over to Listen Talk Radio. You can go around and hang around because not everybody's on 24-7. But stay with SRN1, 148.ca, where you can get a bunch of stuff to read and write and do arithmetic. In the meantime, in between time, it's me, Frank Cotolo, right here on the one and only Cotolo Chronicles. Accept no substitutes, because if you go, people go to, anybody who goes to a bordello, says, you know, can you pump in the show? I think they play at 20. They play at 20. They just keep playing shows. I have so many shows out there. By the way, also, I apologize for constantly telling you that there will be a place to where you can pick up archives of this show. This goes out to the stations who I really want you to support, too, the ones who play the show in repeat. I shouldn't say in repeat, but they play the live show when it's not live, when it's recorded throughout the week. And you could play any show anytime. We're not that timely that you don't find an entertaining show here and there. But my point is, I kept saying there's going to be another site, and there is going to be another site. I'm not going to tell you the name of it, so I don't think you can go there. It's still in operate. It's still being fixed, constructed. That's the word. It had to be broken to be fixed. I'm fixing up this place. The guy says, I'm fixing up this place. I'm fixing up. Why? Is it broken down? It's broken down. I'm fixing it up. When that site does appear, you will be able to go there and download and spend a lot of time with a couple of other shows also, which I am sworn to secrecy at this moment. And I'm a good secret keeper. Are you a good secret keeper? Anyway, in the meantime, in between time, Frank Cotolo, Facebook.com, Frank Cotolo, /, before my name too, Frank Cotolo, I'm there. And all week, you'll be able to download this show if you just want it for yourself. You play it on your iPhone, play it on your iPad. Only when you listen to it live, go to the blog and read those particular little things there and get them on there. And you get to listen to it and all the great stuff we have. The audiences are growing every week. Well, I mean, the people are growing too. It's either growing old or you're growing up, or you're growing. You never stop growing. Okay, so Frank Zappa, we'll dedicate this to you. Maybe Heather knows more about Frank Zappa than I do. I think a lot of people might know more about Frank Zappa. Although when we had Van Dyke Parks on the show some years back, I haven't talked to Van in a while, but he's been busy. He was, of course, a member of the original Mothers of Invention. Then it became Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. Then Frank Zappa did his own stuff. And then he had a child and named her Moon Unit. Moon Unit Zappa. That might have been the beginning of the weird name trend for girls. Just girls? Or guys? Wait a second. His son's name is Zeke. Zeke Zappa or Zappa? Zippy? Zippity? Zippy? You should have named him Zippy. Zippy Zappa. Wow. Frank, how did you miss that one? Zippy Zappa. That would have been great. That would have been a great name. I don't think he would have gotten cursed. You know, because they used to say names were, you know, curses. If you give a kid a stupid name, and other kids, of course, will, in all of their creative wonder, will find a way to make fun of you. But you know what? The kids find a way. They used to. I'm sure they haven't changed in that respect. They always find a way to make fun of kids' names regardless. And kids didn't have funny names when I was a kid. Even in like a grade school. So if you were Frank, you could be Frank the Bank. What does that mean? I'm Frank the Bank. Okay, I'm rich. Fine. Frank the Bank. Frankie Wanky. Wank the Frank. And then they just make up a word. His name is Joe. Joe Schmo. What is a Schmo? No one knows that. Joe Schmo. Joe Schmo to Schmogoglin. Joe Schmogoglin. They just make up things. And it would be, you know, defamatory. Or they would find, and I've talked about this before, one day I'll revisit that great, child-kid thing, I guess 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, that kid creativity that went on. Maybe I'll go back and talk about it. Because kids wouldn't, if they didn't make fun of other kids with their names, they would find something about them, physically, and be able to brand them with that. And they were so incredibly adept at doing that. They were so, they weren't just creative. They weren't just creative because they were intensely attentive to kids. They knew if a kid, and I'll tell you why the funniest thing was, here's, this was probably a stroke of genius. There was a kid in grade school. I mean, talking like fifth, sixth grade. Before we went into junior high school, what now is middle school or whatever they call it. But, and this kid's name was Ted. Now, it just so happened. That Ted had an unusually large head. Now, that was lucky, but the kids, lucky for the kids who wanted to make fun of him, unlucky for him. Now, the kids, and everyone seemed to see it, they saw, they, first of all, they saw that his head was larger than most heads, or not than most heads, but his head was unusually large for his body, and it was noticeable. Kids see that. Kids are like, they're almost, kids are like Sherlock Holmes's. It would be Sherlock's, Sherlock Holmes' eye. Sherlock Holmes' eye. That would be the plural of Holmes, Holmes, Holmes' eye, home eye. Anyway, kids knew that. They saw that Ted had a large head. And he did. I don't know why. That's the way he was born. That was, I don't know. Maybe there were large heads in his family generations ago. I don't know. But he did. Now, isn't it amazing and a fascinating coincidence, but kids picked it up. The guy named Ted, nobody called him Theodore. Okay, so if it was Theodore, they couldn't have rhymed it. But imagine, his head rhymes with Ted. He has a big head. Everyone can see it. So now they can call him, they could brand him with a nickname. It would rhyme, and it's like perfect. Even if you are not one of the kids who were going to point to him and make fun of him, and I'll tell you how they made fun of him, it's a specific way. Even if you were one of those kids, you knew it was perfect. And you know what I'm talking about. He was Ted the Head. And that's how they said it. Oh, Ted the Head. You couldn't say it's Ted the Head. You just say, hey, Ted. But if you were going to say it, you go, Ted the Head. Like, I don't even know where that voice came from. Someone said it. It caught on. It went viral. And at that time, the only virals that went were the ones that we needed to get shots from the doctor. There wasn't the viral thing. It was Ted the Head. So it rhymed. It was perfect. And these Sherlock Holmes eye children everywhere knew it. And it became so stuck to him, this name, so stuck to him that everyone called him that, even if you weren't one of the kids who made up names and made fun of people. The girls. If you wanted to identify this particular head, Ted, this particular Ted, because there were other Teds, you would say, Ted, you mean Ted the Head? And kids would just say it like nothing, like it's nothing, not making fun of them. It's just like, that was his name, it's Ted the Head. Fast, kids are fascinating. Today, I'm sure, is the same as it was back then. And I guess, I don't guess, I know. These are the children who will grow up and eventually do things, because things are needed to be done and needed to be invented. These are the kids who will be the mothers of invention. They will be the mothers because necessity will ask. And the kids who went out there and found the Ted, the Head, the Sherlock Holmes' eye, children of today, it sounds ridiculous what they're doing, but they find out, they brand those people, and then they grow up and they create things, they invent things, and we need them, and they become part of our lives. So don't make fun of these kids who are making fun of other kids, because they are just expressing themselves and feeding that particular thing that makes them grow. Bingo. My name is Frank Cotolo. I'm the man whose name adorns the title of the show. We're going to have Heather Drain, Mondo Heather. She is my favorite redhead. I wish I could make a movie. It's called My Favorite Redhead. And we're going to talk about a whole bunch of things. You're going to be with us when we do that, I'm sure, because you're going to stay here, here as we chronicle. We want to tell you anything else. We want to tell you that more stuff is going to happen because we're going to keep going through May. This is May. I think we have five. We have five shows in May. It's a big month. And we hope to be live. I hope there's no, you know, nothing that takes us away from being live here for the next 5 weeks. It's another Savino Cotolo Chronicles will take place sometime during the month. And we'll have other people on. I know we will. Other guests, other things will happen. You keep going to the blog, CotoloChronicles.blogspot.com, to find out what's going on. Go to my Facebook page, be my friend. Say, yes, I know Frank Cotolo, and I want to be his friend. And I'll make him my friend. I don't know what happens. I don't know what the limit is now. I might be getting close to the limit. I have no idea. I just do it. Or send me a message or do something. Or if you can't, fcotolo@yahoo.com. We can ask me questions, find out what's going on, ask about where the show is going, what you got, ideas for the show. You have ideas for guests, whatever the case may be. fcotolo@yahoo.com. I'll even talk to you there if I got time. We can chat. What else? I guess nothing else except Heather. Only Heather, who is available, I'm sure, waiting for the call. I haven't talked to Heather in so long. To hear her voice again. There it is. To hear her voice again is going to lift me. I will be lifted when I hear her voice again. It's been so long since I heard her voice. See how many had that little laugh in the back?
Can you hear me?
She picked it up. Listen to that laugh.
Frank!
It's the kind of laugh that just means, you know, you hear a laugh like that and you say to yourself, I think I want to live a little longer. That's a one.
The check is in the mail.
No, I haven't heard from you so long. I was just telling everybody that you're not just a favorite person of mine. You're literally my favorite redhead.
Oh, well, thank you. You're my favorite Frank.
There are a lot. There are less and less Franks in the world. The name just doesn't ring anymore.
I think it'll come back though.
I was just talking about, because at the beginning of the show when I do this little collage, and because of you, I played something weird in the collage. I played the Mothers of Invention doing Call My Vegetable.
Oh, nice.
Or Call the Vegetable. Call a Vegetable. What is it called? Call any Vegetable. And I was talking a bit about Frank Zappa, and I couldn't remember his son's name, but I remember that his daughter's name is Moon Unit.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, it's when I thought, I said, wow, he should have named his son Zippy. It would have been a Zippy Zappa.
Zippy Zappa. It sounds like an old Borscht Belt comic name, doesn't it?
Yeah. Let's hear it. Except how did he get in if he was Italian?
Yeah.
Zippy Zappa. Yeah. You know what it sounds like? It sounds like a monkey.
Right. Yeah. It does. Actually, yeah. It is a simian.
Well, anyway, in any event, in all events, and certainly in this event, I'm so happy that it turned out that you could be on. I never give up on you. I just keep trying.
You are the most patient man. I should call you Saint Frank for putting up with me.
It's like I get carried away, but I do accept the halo. Now, why have you been so busy based on all these wonderful things that I tell people you do and stuff? What have you been doing? Just fill us in a little bit on Mondo Heather, the great blog. When you go to Mondo Heather, you have to actually say, look, I know there's some weird stuff on here, so I agree to watch it. Do you know that?
Oh, absolutely. No, I put that in I think it's good for people to be forewarned. I mean, most of the stuff on the blog is probably more in the PG-13, probably soft R category. But just in case, I mean, you know, especially if someone's at work, I don't want them pulling up something and having them get in trouble, you know, or anything like that.
Yeah, I thought it was, you know, it's tame by comparison to so many things, but I think it's that's a thoughtful of you to do that. So why have you been so busy? I know you were sick for a while, but a lot of people caught that bug. Is that it?
Right? Oh my God. It was just a multitude of things. But yeah, I've been busy just, you know, really working. I'm actually, because I'm a masochist, I'm working on the last time we talked, I was working on, a film book.
Yeah.
And, or actually more of a culture book, a French culture book. And I'm still working on that, but, I'm kind of taking a break on that, and I'm working on a different film book in addition to, you know, doing the blog. I also write for Dangerous Minds, the great website, and, you know, of course I freelance for other places as well, you know, which will probably come up here in a bit.
Yes, it will, because you really have paved a great little road for yourself, considering what you do. There's so many people out there. I mean, you could do a show just on how to network and make yourself available to do things and write things and do things on the net, because you really have you really built it up from nothing.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, because I look back, you know, because I just had a birthday recently, and I've been writing professionally for probably a little over 10 years now, and which feels weird to say that, but
when you get to 30.
I'm looking forward to it. I love getting older, you know, because it's the older you get, the more you can look back on your past self and be like, oh my God, at least I'm not that dumb anymore. You know,
it's true, but it comes at a big price. So. But anyway, go ahead. What? So you in 10 years you built yourself a great resume of work.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, any advice, I actually was very blessed about, I'd say like a year ago, I had, an aspiring, you know, actually two different people. One was kind of just an aspiring writer, someone who was really super green, asked me for advice. And I had another friend who's actually a very talented writer, but he only kind of, you know, he mainly had a blog and he was wanting to branch out. And like the best advice I think you can ever give to anybody is just do it, you know, just write and send your stuff out. I mean, you know, you have to, you know, you're going to get a lot of rejection, so you have to develop that thick skin. I mean, you're a writer too, so I know you know all about this. Mm-hmm. And you know, you just have to, it's part of the gig, but you just have to keep trying. I mean, if you don't put yourself out there, then you're definitely never, you know, going to get anywhere.
But of course, another thing I always tell people is try to specialize in something once you start getting known for doing something, it's okay to have your own little, you want to be a brand, and that way you become the person they go to for that thing, and hopefully whatever area that might be is something that you love, and like you do, love to do and stuff. So it's not just that you paved yourself a great road to be a freelancer, but to be able to do what you love and what you know, great, because you just... And we've talked about this before. Ever since a kid, you were picking up all this information, watching what everybody else called junk, and finding the jewels and the junk and the treasure and the in what everybody would dismiss: B movies, C movies, E movies, F movies.
I love E movies.
It's a whole new meaning now when you put E in front. E or I, it's a whole new thing, yeah.
Right.
And I was thinking of you last week, too. Not that I don't think about you, but I do. I think about, because the Turner Channel movie, whatever, they were showing a bunch of old black and white 50s monster horror movies, whatever you want to call it. And one of my favorites, which I've talked about endlessly on here, The Incredible Shrinking Man, was on. Mm-hmm. But they also had some real doggy. I don't know how to classify these, you know. There's that whole series of It, They, and there actually is a movie called Them. You know, it's It, They, Them. It came, they came from outer space. It came from under the sea. They went into, found it, and then crazy. But I always think when I remember those movies, when I see those, whatever it is, I mean, I'm brought back to those are movies from my childhood. And I think of you because you're a young person, and yet you have such a wealth of knowledge that goes way back.
Oh, thank you.
Well, you do. You don't have to keep thanking me, but you do. Like, for instance, what is the first, history-wise, what would you consider to be like one of the first real junky B-movies that was made for nothing, that was just a, even if it was exploitation or what have you, even go back in the black and white days or even the silent. I don't know. What was one of the first real movies that everybody went and went looked and went, oh boy, now there's going to be junk?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, there's always been, you know, B-movies and exploitation films practically since cinema, you know, was born. I mean, in the early 1900s, you had, like, you know, films about the slave trade and the dangers of drug use. And, of course, you know, there's always a moral message, but it's also, you know, giving people a chance to see something that's taboo and forbidden. And, you know, as far as, like, crappy, I mean, I don't know. It's, if there's humanity touching something, you're going to have some jewels, but you're going to have, you know, you're going to have stinkers, and that could be Troll 2, or it could be, you know, Battlefield Earth. You know, it can definitely...
I always wonder, though, back in the days of, let's say, right, you know, after Chaplin, when things the moving pictures really started to flourish and become like a business. I wonder how many that we've never seen. I mean, movies that were made by people independently who were just trying to cash in on, you know, having a movie that was kind of an exploitation thing or whatever. I mean, just, I wonder how many of those were made and lost. And I don't know if there were many. I mean, in those days, was it as prevalent? Because the equipment was hard to get, and I mean, you had to be connected to someone, or you had to have money. You couldn't just go out and do it. Even in the 50s, you could do that because you could rent equipment and stuff. Today, of course, we could do it in our basement. But
right.
Yeah, but that's the metamorphosis of it. But I wonder how much footage and stuff there is out there aside from Steg films, of course, which is the obvious underground early on, you know. When I think, you know, because they knew that could sell and it was illegal and what have you, but, and people were using, I don't know what they were using. I mean, is there such a thing as, well, there must have been black market cameras and everything. Do you have any information about any of that stuff historically?
Historically, I mean, as far as the technical means, no, I don't, but there's always been, I mean, people, you know, I mean, I think a lot of times with your smaller budget films, you know, you didn't, obviously getting a hold of 35 millimeter cameras. I mean, 35 millimeter has always been expensive. That's always been pretty much since film was kind of codified. But you know, you'd have people that would shoot in 16, and you'd also have like even more underground types use like 8 millimeter cameras and, you know, but yeah, there's always been kind of, you know, an underground. I guess when there's a will, there's a way. I mean, that's why we, you know, that's how we got such great underground filmmakers like Kenneth Anger. I mean, I don't think, you know, I mean, he didn't have a lot of producers, obviously, when he made Fireworks in the 40s. But he had a camera and he had an idea and, you know, made something groundbreaking. So I think that's the beauty about, I think, independent film. It's like, you know, it's kind of a testament to human ingenuity. You know, if you got a vision and you've got the determination and, you know, just work your butt off and, you know, get it out there.
This is a good time to tell everybody to make sure you're writing some of this stuff down, because you're going to hear names of movies and names maybe you haven't heard before. And later on, you can go to, and don't just go to Mondo Heather, but, you know, you can go searching and see what you could find of this stuff. Because I know that most of the people who just are just moviegoers, I mean, they're not historians, they're not, they're just neophyte movie people, are just going to remember the names that everybody knows or what have you. But there is, and that's one of the reasons we love having Heather on, there's a plethora of material out there that is still, I think, even available, whether it's on the net or YouTube, probably runs entire movies now, and they're weird ones, and you can, I'm sure Netflix has a bunch of really, really strange movies. But why don't you tell us what, as early as you could remember, historically, what was the first film that was just made, but nobody expected it to be like a classic, and it just struck a nerve that that got, you know, like, and got the underground, you know, a recognition? I mean, what was the first movie that was made legitimately? And forget about these people with 8s and 16 millimeters and stuff like that. What would you say is one? One of the first.
You know, and I'm sure, like, after this interview, I'm going to think of, like, an early example, because that's right. The way my brain works. But I guess, I mean, I would probably say, like, Un Chien Andalou.
Ooh.
You know, the Buñuel Dali short film, which is brilliant. If anybody out there hasn't seen it, see it. I'm sure it's on YouTube. It's very short. And because that was definitely one of the earliest examples, at least, of film that has survived. I mean, people, the artists have experimented with film for a long time, even up to that point, you know, a long time, meaning, I guess, like, you know, a decade or two. But Un Chien Andalou is really kind of one of the big, I think, like, trailblazers and hallmark of certainly, you know, I don't know if I'd call it underground, but definitely alternative cinema. I mean, you know, it's especially what they were doing in Europe over in, you know, the 20s and 30s, early 30s, was just mind-blowing. You know, you compare, like, American silent film to, say, what they were doing in Germany. I mean, and I love American silent film, but it's almost like night and day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at Metropolis versus, you know, even something good. I mean, I love the Gold Rush, but Metropolis smokes it.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's still, there are things in that film that still, you know, as a modern day viewer, you watch and you're just like, you know, your breath's almost taken away. It just floors you.
And what's great too is that it's not, obviously not CSI. I mean, it's not, did I say that? CGI. I'm sorry. I said CSI.
It's not CSI either.
Stupid TV shows. CSI. CGI. They should answer to it. Miami. CGI. They should have. And forced to create something looking realistic and yet surrealistic, because they didn't have all the great technical special effects equipment. They really did. And, you know, they benefited from the fact that that was black and white. A color probably would have taken a lot of the surrealism out of it, don't you think?
Oh, you know, actually, I would agree. I think one thing that a lot of people kind of have lost, I think, nowadays is that when you have to light anything that's black and white, lighting black and white is not easy, because you have to emphasize a lot of grays and shadows and depths and all of that stuff. And so there's a definite art to lighting black and white. I mean, you know, great lighting is always good in any color, or black and white, but black and white in particular. And just yeah, there were definitely people that knew how to get the best out of that look. I think it still looks great.
I think you answered the question, though, when I was talking about, when I asked about early movies, I think you wound up answering it by just saying the things they were doing in Europe, because obviously they were already in a different, they already had a different sense of art at that time. And they had their own brands of, you know, Dolly. I mean, you know, I don't think Dolly could have been born and raised in Casper, Wyoming, you know?
Perhaps not. I mean, Dolly was really, I mean, the early 1900s, I think, were such a wonderful, wonderful, fertile ground of art. I mean, because you had, like, the surrealists, you know, like Dolly, and you had the Dada movement. And with cinema, you have, you know, the German Expressionist movement, and, you know, I mean, obviously there are great artists, you know, in our country too, but I think over there they were just, it was a little more forward thinking as far as mainstream.
There were also artists over there who were artists of other types who got interested in doing film, like Dali. I mean, there were artists who painted, there were artists who did sculptures. They got interested in doing film as another medium. You know, there's a movie, Gregory, you'll know this too. Gregory Peck is in this movie. I think it's a Hitchcock movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It, you know, it's one of those one turn. I don't know if it's Suspicion. It's not Notorious. It's either Suspicion or Nutrition or something like that.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
But there's a scene. There's a dream scene in it. I believe it's Gregory Peck has a dream scene, and it was created by Dali.
Yes.
Remember?
Yes. With all the eyes.
Yeah.
And it took, like, hit. You. I'm trying to. Yeah. I want to say. I think it was.
Suspicion?
Was it not Notorious?
No, Notorious was the one with Cary Grant, wasn't it? And Ingmar Bergman. She looks like the regular did nothingness. I remember.
Oh,
I don't know why.
God.
I remember that out of nowhere. She looks like the regular. That was Notorious. Might have been Suspicious. You know, he made a bunch of movies like that. Maybe you people out there listening can go look that one up.
It's Spellbound.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Thank you.
Yay.
Spellbound. Yes. If anybody gets a chance to see that, it's probably on YouTube. You could probably go Salvatore Dali Spellbound. You'll probably see the scene. So
It's amazing.
So what happens is there were certain, like Hitchcock, that was Hitchcock, but he was English anyway, so he wasn't even American, but he was working in America after England, but he probably, I mean, he recognized Dolly on film and made him do that. Also, you know that I knew this from the Groucho Marx biography, but Salvador Dali actually wrote, he really loved the Marx Brothers, and he wrote a Marx Brothers script, which
they, oh my God.
They just could not do. But Groucho said it was, you know, it was completely nuts, and but, you know, he liked it in a way, but they never could get any support to do stuff like that, but Dali and films that, and of course there's a lot of Dali film stuff, but and there are other, well, I don't know, what about Godard and those guys, were they, you know, were they, and Truffaut came along, and weren't they, they were film people, but they were artists first, weren't they some kind of, I mean, they didn't just do film, did they?
You know, I'll be honest, French New Wave is,
it's New Wave stuff, yeah.
Yeah, that's an area I'm still kind of educating myself about it, to be honest. I've spent a good chunk of my life kind of researching more, like, you know, kind of exploitation films. And I love art films. Right. I mean, I do have a base in art films, too, and foreign films. But for some reason, of all the countries, like, France has been one I'm just now starting to kind of peek into. I do know there was Cocteau, who did Beauty and the Beast.
Yes, yeah.
And it makes sense. And actually, more modern day. I mean, David Lynch, had his background was in art, and he still does art. His paintings are pretty incredible.
And Warhol did movies after doing art too, right? Of course.
Oh, Warhol, yeah. Andy, which I'm a huge, huge Warhol fangirl. I've been since I was in my teens.
Really? Because that stuff is, you know, his Frankenstein and Dracula. That is so hard. I don't know why.
I love those, but those are actually Paul Morrissey. That's a little known fact. It's the stuff that Andy actually directed.
Right.
It's more stuff like, you know, Eat, Sleep, Empire, Blue Movie. I think the last one that he properly directed might have been Chelsea Girls. And even then, I think at that point, Paul Morrissey was probably kind of involved. But I love Paul Morrissey. I mean, I think he's great. I think Warhol, like any great, truly great artists, had a catalytic ability to kind of find, like, you know, to attract other artists and kind of help them shine a little bit and be like, you know, with the whole factory star system and the Velvet Underground, you know, I think Warhol was just brilliant. I love him.
Let's switch now over to recent, well, not, well, I don't know how recent, but let's look at contemporary stuff that, because I was saying before that there really is no more underground per se, that everybody who was, when I remember, and you know too, because you guys have done so much underground stuff and cable stuff and your husband's done all that stuff, but in general, I find it interesting that a lot of the people who I knew from the underground in these 70s and 80s, that they're all using the net as a theater. There's so little analog underground anymore. It's all digital. And so the underground is kind of merged with the, I guess, mainstream. I said, well, it's not the overground. We never called it the overground. Why'd we call it the underground? So, and what's happening, because it's right. I mean, there are names on Facebook and people who asked me to be friends and stuff that I went like, wow, here's a person you never thought in a million years would, like, get into this. But, you know, they have to be on Facebook. So the underground people have come up, and they're like, okay now. And you know, because the gamut of things displayed by the Internet. So what, who is getting that, who is getting the buzz? Who's the buzz these last couple of years with whatever you're talking about? Those, you know, exploit those kind of films. Last time we were here, we talked about, I told you I saw that Vampire Strippers. Was that it? Was that what it was called?
Was it Zombie Strippers?
Yeah, the Zombie Strippers. Oh, man,
that's right. No, I'm pretty sure. There are a couple of Vampire Stripper films.
Okay.
That's almost like a subgenre.
But now that vampires, but now that the vampires are walking, all this stuff has gone so commercial. You know, Walking Dead and Walking Vampires and the kids with the werewolves and stuff. Who's doing anything else?
Well, I think I've always been of the belief, I think the underground will always be there. And I think, you know, independent cinema you know, these things will always be there, but I think with technology and just with the changing tide, you know, of culture, it takes different shapes. And it's kind of, in some ways, we live in a very exciting age because now there's so much more accessibility to things. I mean, because it's like, you know, yeah, if, you know, the underground's great in the 70s if you lived in, you know, if you're lucky enough to live in New York City or L.A. or, you know, a big enough metropolitan type area where you go to theater. But if you're living in the South or the Midwest, you know, forget it. You're kind of screwed out of getting to see some really cool stuff.
Still, huh?
Now, well, not now. I'm talking about like in the 70s.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right.
But with now with the internet, I mean, you know, you have more accessibility. I think with the whole, as far as like horror goes, I think it's kind of, I mean, I've heard The Walking Dead's really good. And actually, my husband is a huge fan of it. I need to watch it. I got kind of burnt out on zombies for about 2 years because they were like everywhere. And I mean, I love a great zombie film too. I mean, but The Beyond, you know, is one of my favorite films ever. But
I'm amazed at how many, you know, I tell kids, I'm kids, but I mean, everybody's a kid to me now. I'm so freaking old.
You're not that.
But I tell them, I say, look, you know, the zombie stuff, you know, when I was a kid and I was watching these, you know, and now I have to say what African Americans, I can't say when I was a kid, they used to say, oh, you know, you got the Negroes were zombies. They were all Negroes. And they kept their eyes open, right? Weren't they? Because it all stemmed from the voodoo thing. And all those old zombie movies are black guys walking around with big eyes, right?
Well, yeah, no. I mean, that's kind of funny because, yeah, I mean, zombies, you know, like White Zombie was really the first with Bela Lugosi. And then, of course, you had I Walked with a Zombie. You know, you had films like that. And then it wasn't really, to my memory, until really Romero did Night of the Living Dead that really changed. That film was a game changer in like 8 different ways.
Yeah.
But one of the biggest ones is, I mean, it established a different convention.
And that's the 60s.
Yeah.
So all the time before that, we had, and am I right to assume that it really, that the whole idea of zombie in the 30s and 40s and 50s, when they were doing those movies and they were always black people, am I right to assume that's because they picked it up from, they thought it was a voodoo type of thing? And
yeah, it was more of the voodoo, the Haitian type, type thing. And usually very malinformed, you know.
Right. Well, of course. But it was different. And that was it. And that's why, look, you just mentioned a movie, White Zombie. It was like, why? What? I mean, think about that now. It's like, well, so what? Aren't zombies are white? They're black? They're Asian? I mean, the zombie world is now open to any religion, color, creed.
Right. It's
It was once zero.
It's equality.
It was pigeonholed at one point. And you couldn't be unless. In fact, I bet you a lot of African Americans, you know, got off of there was that whole studio section that played all the you know, the Negro section that just played and made those movies that were, you know, for that audience. I'll bet you a lot of those guys jumped ship. They were able to be in like they were B and C movies to us, but. To most the northern Caucasians, they know that to them it would be like a wow, that's like an A film.
Yeah, well, in some of those films, I mean, I think White Zombie's legitimately good. I Walked with a Zombie, which I believe was Jacques Tourneur, if I'm saying that right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a legitimately good movie. I mean, so it's good. You know, there was some definitely quality stuff being made. But yeah, it is funny how like mainstream. So, I mean, of all the things, zombies, because werewolves and vampires especially have these little resurgences that happen every, you know, everything's cyclical anyways, but, you know, it's like every few years kind of horror comes back. It never goes away, but it'll come back in the mainstream. And, but zombies, I mean, while they've always been there, you know, zombies are always a little, I think, you know, if we're talking like Romero, post-Romero, we're always a little hardcore for people because there's usually gore and brain eating. And, you know, most people would rather see a cute little vampire, you know, just sucking some blood than seeing somebody munching you know, on entrails. But now it's become, I mean, it's, you know, this huge, I mean, you have zombie walks and zombie proms and it's
what
something
do you think,
else.
What do you think about how the whole zombie thing has gone in movies and TV, or just in generally in film and video, whatever. How do you feel it has, it's better or not better because of how it has progressed graphically?
I think it's always like a, you know, there's always a flip of the coin. I mean, you know, I think some people have made some amazing stuff, and I think a lot of it's kind of that goose is cooked, and I think it's kind of time for either someone to kind of approach it in a completely different manner, or maybe just have it take a break. I don't know. I mean, that's the thing. I think the beauty of art is that you can make it be any whatever you want. And mm-hmm. But the only way you're ever going to be really original is just how you approach it. Nothing's really new.
That's right.
If you break it down, but right. You know, if you approach, right. And I really think that's what horror in general. It's funny. I was talking, with Chuck, my husband, the other day, and just I was complaining because so many, even like horror films that you know are well made nowadays, they all have that same bleeding lighting scheme. Everything. I probably complained about this in the last episode because this is one of my constant rants. But everything is lit the same. Everything is like these muted earth tones.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah. You need to make a movie eventually. Would you like to do that eventually?
Well, it's funny you mention that because when I was a teenager, that was my goal. Mm-hmm. I was originally going to be a director. And I almost went to film school and everything. But, film writing ended up being that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're young yet. you can get it together. So that's the zombie stuff. What's great, I think, is that how stuff is continually stuff that really has depth to it will be like you said, be reshaped, reformed, and another angle of it. There's never any one movie that will totally define Dracula because right there's so many angles to go by. Look at when they brought it back to Broadway with Frank Langella in the 70s, and they just hyped up the sexual side of it.
Right. No, and
it's the same play, though. Same thing.
Exactly. Yeah, because it was the Hamilton Dean play that Lugosi did mm-hmm. back in the 20s. It's now, granted, the Langella had the advantage of having a set designed by Edward Gorey. Mm-hmm. Which, how cool is that?
Well, yeah, the fact that his name is Gorey, I think, just
right.
alone is amazing. Well, that was a play also, though. That he made the movie. We saw the movie, but they brought him back and made the in the play. That was on Broadway.
Right. No,
yeah, and that was a gigantic hit again, another generation. But that if they had done it in the in the Bela Lugosi style, Broadway style, I think everyone would have been asleep by the second act, or maybe sooner.
Yeah, I think part of that, too, is that Dracula, because I'm a huge fan of the book, and in fact, my current book project kind of ties into this, because I've always researched vampire cinema in general, but the thing with Dracula book is Dracula's in it very little. I mean, mm-hmm. if you actually read the book, he's probably in a handful of pages, max. So most of the book is just like journal entries mm-hmm. of the different characters. So translating that to film can be tricky because how are people not going to be bored?
Right. And look what Coppola did to it.
Oh my God. I have like such a love-hate thing for that film.
Yeah. I always watch it hoping I'll connect to the kissing scene with Winona Ryder. I know it's sick, isn't it? But I'm always, I'm upfront about my sickness. No, there's a, but that doesn't just take the sexual side seriously. Because look at those vampires that get Keanu Reeves, the girls.
Oh, I know, and that was a scene ruined by Keanu Reeves is good in other things. He was miscast.
You think he ruined that scene? Did he ruin that scene?
Oh my! Well, just there's one point where he's screaming and he looks like Butthead from Beavis and Butthead, and I hate saying that because he seems like a nice and I like him in other films, but the fact that it was so sexualized. I mean, Stoker was a Victorian gentleman.
Right.
I think Stoker would have been horrified. There is a sexuality to the book, but it's a poison one. It's like vampirism is basically a metaphor for venereal disease.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so. And plus, it looked like a meatloaf video. I don't know. It was just, it could have been.
I, you know
there are great things in that film.
I think to myself, because a Coppola, being this city Italian guy, I'm thinking to myself, what was that entire scene? In other words, they might have spent a day or two on that scene, you know, when, by the time they cut it up, what we saw. But I wonder what he has. I'm telling you, I believe he had a ball with that thing. And he probably has the whole, you have like an hour of it somewhere in his house. But anyway, but you're right about that. Stoker, and that book, how it was taken and changed. But my original point was that particular, you know, the same thing with Frankenstein. I remember reading, Shelley's book and, when I was younger, and that's after I had seen, the Universal movies, and then they were just starting to do the Hammer movies. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading it and going, and it was, you know, it was like the difference between, when someone gave me a Tarzan book after watching Johnny Weissmuller play this incredibly dumb guy who wondered why he didn't have the hair, or jumping around, you know, and then listening to, Tarzan speak in the books, like he did when Christopher Lambert did the movie, when they redid it so that it was more like the book. Mm-hmm. So when watching Boris Karloff's and that the mass, I don't know what you call it, the commercial Frankenstein's monster compared to the book, and that's, you know, and then later on, obviously people felt the same way I did. That's why De Niro wanted to do it.
Right. Yeah, it's and that is kind of the beauty with anything based on a book is, you know, there's always different ways you can interpret it. I mean, even with the Coppola version of Dracula, I mean, there were things in there that were really good. It's like the soundtrack's amazing.
Well, this is what I'm saying, though. There's like there are these certain pieces that just keep being addressed in their original form. It's not like they're on the 50,000th sequel of a Frankenstein idea. They're not. Right. They just, I mean, someone comes in and says, I'll do the whole of Dracula. I'll do it all from the beginning. I'll do it the way I'm going to do it. This way. And those pieces last forever and constantly appeal to audiences. As opposed to, well, how many nights, didn't they redo Night of the Living Dead in color? Didn't he do it himself?
No, actually, Tom Savini, who of course has worked with Romero on a lot of projects, he directed a version in 1990 that was a remake that I've known some fans that didn't like it. I thought it was good. I mean, nothing's going to touch the original, of course, but I thought it was good. I kind of liked the Barbara character who was played by Patricia Tallman. And she was kind of a stronger, kind of more tough Barbara, and that was kind of cool. So, I thought Savini did a good job. But yeah, I think with some stories, you know, especially something as classic as Frankenstein and Dracula, is that there's something timeless about these stories. And there's something timeless, you know, there's a strange humanity in these stories that I think are eternally appealing, and you know, there are different elements of both books, I mean, especially Dracula, that haven't quite been nailed. I mean, I don't think there's been one really perfect version of Dracula. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are versions of Dracula that I think are brilliant, but you know, I'm not sure if one has truly nailed down the book yet.
We have Heather Drain with us. She is the queen of the archives of all these I don't know what to call them. I guess off the beaten track. It's not even off the beaten track. Some of the stuff is very mainstream now. But if you hear, Heather has studied this and done this, and I've actually seen Heather do some acting on cable television, and that's like that's about my speed of acting, I may add. And she's with us here on Cotola Chronicles Y2K Plus 13, and this is our first of five shows in May. Now, what about the? What about Del Toro? What about Universal's reboot of The Wolfman? Was that too CGI for you, or what? What did you feel about that one?
It's funny. I haven't seen that one yet. And it's the weird thing is I saw it. Well, I remember reading the article when it was being made, and I was initially, like, really pumped because, like, some of the people attached to it were really, like, clearly they loved Lon Chaney Jr. film, and they really wanted to honor that. And I think Benicio del Toro is a phenomenal actor. I love him. I thought he was great in Fear and Loathing, and he's great in a lot of things. But then basically, it seemed like I'd read that a lot of the cool people that were all about it got booted. And I read a review of it written by a friend of mine, and it sounded kind of like things got watered down. I mean, I'll give it a chance at some point. I mean, I'm a firm believer. You can't really write off anything completely until you give it at least somewhat of a chance.
But, well, you have to watch at least once. It's amazing how it bombed. It's not amazing. Things bomb easily. And speaking of bombs, there was a movie I wanted to see recently. And because I still have not seen a new 3D movie. Have you?
you may laugh at this. I've only seen one, and it was for a date night, and I picked it, and it was Jackass 3D.
Was it? I don't know the difference anymore. You see, when I was a kid, they were shoving 3D down our throats, that kind. I have no idea what it's like now.
Right. Well, the 3D in Jackass was pretty good.
Jackass 3D.
It is funny. I mean, because I've actually you're seeing films that weren't shot in 3D being released in these three, like The Lion King, and now they've done it with Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
And I'm not honestly quite sure how that's gonna work.
I don't know how they do that.
Yeah, because the full 3D process, and this was true in the 50s, and it's, I'm sure it's true now, is that if a film's going to be in 3D, there's certain things you have to take into consideration. You have to, plan it. And
yes.
So I don't know how you're going to make something 3D that wasn't shot with that in mind. But.
Well, there was a movie recently that was, they made a, they came up with a combination of Jack and the Beanstalk and Jack the Giant Killer. And they made this movie called Jack the Giant Slayer.
Oh, yeah, I heard of that.
And it's in 3D. I didn't get it. It bombed so quickly that it went away. But I read a review of it in the New Yorker of all places, and they just loved the living daylights out of it. And I'm thinking to myself, you can't get a 3D. A film now on DVD or something and then watch it at home in 3D, can you? I mean, you got to have equipment, right? You can't do it now. So now it's not even, I wanted to see that in 3D. It's not going to be in a theater again.
Well, there are actually 3D like TVs. Some of the newer TVs do have that capability. Actually my parents have one. So I've
you
got to
have a special TV.
Well, yeah, you have a special TV, and it comes with glasses, and it's not bad. It's nothing I would ever pay extra money for, just because there's really, the only things I'm really excited about seeing in 3D would be anything that's old school. I'm not really, there's some new school stuff I wouldn't mind seeing that's 3D, but I'm not, beholden,
No, I just want to know the difference, because, I mean, it really hurt to a lot of the early ones, I saw when I was living and working in Hollywood. It's fortunate if you're in the town that is known, that movies built, because there'll always be something particularly special. Like I was able to see a pristine print, and this is in the 80s, of The Creature from the Black Lagoon in 3D.
Oh,
see?
Nice. See, that would be way more exciting to me than.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
it was
good, but it was hard. It's still hard to watch because of the glasses or what have you. And I know it's got to be like 100, maybe more times better, doesn't it now? I don't understand. I don't know. I got to see it to make the comparison. I also saw, and not a lot of people know this. Well, film people know this, but I was watching a couple of weeks ago. I was watching Hitchcock. I was watching Dial M for Murder with somebody. Mm-hmm. And I said, why these weird camera angles aren't just because that's Hitchcock and he does things like that. They're done because he took the play, it was a play, and he made it in 3D. And that was a 3D movie.
Wow. I love that, because I don't think a lot of people, I mean, that's not something I think you hear a whole lot. Nobody really associates 3D with Hitchcock.
Right. And he actually put... put holes in the floor and squares in the floor so he could shoot up, so that a table would be in front. All that, so it was, and I saw that in 3D, and it was an entirely different experience because, here he is trying to actually recreate a play, and you're sitting in because you see a play in 3D. It's not a film. You know, it's not one-dimensional. But anyway. Maybe last year, I had this guy on. I think his name was, I forgot, wait, I got his name here somewhere. I know it's on my, let me just look at it, because I don't want to misquote him, but I wanted to know if you knew anything about this. He's a Hollywood guy, and he's worked in various movies and things and stuff. Mm-hmm. And he came on because he had started a Kickstarter. He had a Kickstarter campaign, and he was producing, trying to release a movie. I know I have him down here. That was already really already done and finished, mm-hmm. and he was trying to get it out there because they didn't have a distributor. Oh God, where is that? I think it was Philip. Is this him? Philip Margo. Is that his name? Philip Margo? Maybe it was Philip Margo. Anyway, have you ever heard of a movie called Birdemic?
Oh, yeah. No, that's funny. You know, a friend of mine showed me, like, a trailer. Has he been trying to get this
Jeff
out
Gross.
For a couple of years?
Jeff Gross. That's his name. Jeff Gross.
Right. No, a friend of mine showed me a trailer for that a couple of years ago.
Yes,
it looked pretty funny. I mean, it looked ridiculous, but I mean, ridiculous is a good thing sometimes.
Yeah, I believe it's a Japanese guy who put it together, and this guy had put a lot of money into. He thought this was the greatest thing since Italian Bread, and. I don't know. I mean, I really haven't seen a lot happen to it. I told him he'd be on the show again, but I know. I said, you know, I got to ask Kathy. Where'd you go here on this list? Oh, I lost you on the list. How could you be lost? You're on. I'm hearing you. Oh well, doesn't matter. I guess. So what are you when you're writing? What are you writing about these days? It seems that you have an awful lot of things to write about because the cinema is really filled with the kind of stuff that you would write about, and it's now very much mainstream. Like, what's the hottest thing, right? Isn't it?
Well, it depends. I mean, like, kind of the films that I like to write about, or just art in general, whether it's, you know, film or music or what have you. I mean, it's stuff that, you know, I mean, some of it's not super underground anymore, but the average bear, you know, probably still isn't that familiar. For example, recently, like, we lost a great, you know, filmmaker in the form of Jess Franco, who's a Spanish filmmaker who made literally hundreds of movies. I was asked to contribute a little, you know, a piece kind of, you know, about Franco for Movie Morlocks, which is a great blog. That's actually the official blog for Turner Classic via one of the writers, Kimberly Lindbergh, who's a brilliant writer. She's awesome. But Jess Franco is a guy that, you know, I mean, for people that are into the type of films I'm into, I mean, we all know him, and he's one of the big dogs. But, you know, I think if you ask the average, you know, moviegoer, they're going to be like, who? You know, and that's exactly why, like, it's good for us to get this, you know, our writing and our words out there, because guys like Franco, you know, he did some great work, and he wasn't like anybody else.
Give us some of the work that maybe some people do know or what
are we talking biggest about? Right. With Franco, his biggest known films, well, there's a few. One, he actually did, speaking of Dracula, he did a film with Christopher Lee. It was actually one of the very few non-Hammer Dracula films Christopher Lee did, called Count Dracula, a.k.a. El Conde Dracula. Oh. And that's actually a pretty good version. One of the reasons Lee agreed to do it was that, because Lee always was frustrated with Hammer because, you know, I mean, none of the Hammer Draculas are really accurate to the book, you know, in the spirit of Dracula at all. The, you know, horror, yeah. Dracula a little bit, but not by much. And so Lee really wanted to do it right. And so Franco gave him that opportunity. There's still, you know, a few things that aren't quite accurate to the book, but it's closer certainly to the book than any of the Hammer stuff. And it also has the great Klaus Kinski as Renfield. And he's amazing in that, of course. And, you know, but Franco also did Succubus.
I remember that movie. That was a weird one. That was a weird one. And I mean,
oh, it's great. Yeah. I know. Franco was a huge jazz fan and a jazz musician. And a lot of his films, to me, kind of play like abstract jazz, you know?
Yes,
like, and
yes,
I say that with complete love.
Yes. But,
But yeah, he did one called Vampiros Lesbos, which I think the title alone has kind of made it popular with a lot of people because, of course, people love lesbian vampires. You know, it's like chocolate and peanut butter. And,
absolutely. It's what being dead is all about.
Absolutely. But actually, you know, that's the thing I love about these films. And Franco was, you know, somebody could rent that expecting like, hey, yeah, baby, you know, yeah, kind of not. Like go into it and then have kind of this weird, arty, strange stuff going on. And that's the beauty of Jess Franco. So that's the type of artist that I live for. I live for people that kind of did things their way and, you know, put their kind of thumbprint, you know, their unique thumbprint on whatever they did.
You know, speaking of that, it certainly has, at one time, strict or hardcore porn tried to, you know, they were doing porn inside of movies, trying to do, you know, parodies and things and stuff. I guess they still do parodies. I don't know, but that the whole idea of putting hardcore sex into a movie just to get it distributed and made it a porn film, and then trying to do like a wacky little film at the same time. That's pretty much gone, isn't it? That's the whole stuff like in, you know, in Boogie Nights, the Burt Reynolds guy is always, he actually wants to make a film. You know, it's like weird.
Well, I think you have like, and I love that you touched upon this because I think this is something you definitely don't see nowadays, but you had two types of things of that stripe back in the 70s. And one was you would have films that were R-rated, that were shot R-rated, they were not adult in any capacity, and you'd have distributors insert explicit X-rated action into it to sell it to a different market. The weirdest example of this, and this I think happened in Italy, they took the film, the Andrew Stevens film Massacre at Central High, which is an awesome film, not sexy at all, okay? Like, not a sexy film. They inserted some, like, you know, basically pornographic footage into it and retitled it Sexy Jeans, which I feel sorry for whatever person went to that theater expecting a good time with Mr. Hand, because like that's not it's a brilliant film. The guy that made it, Dutch filmmaker Rene Dalder, is a genius, but holy cow, I cannot, you know, that makes no, you know, makes no sense. So, but you had that, but then you did have, I think, people that legitimately were filmmakers that, kind of riding the tide of, you know, the sexual revolution, in the late 60s and 70s really tried to do something, you know, tried to kind of use adult themes in films that, you know, that the whole purpose wasn't just a prurient one. It was like an art one. And I mean, like, I think Gerard Damiano was one of them, certainly with Devil and Mrs. Jones. And, you know, you had guys later on like Cecil Howard, who made a really great film called Firestorm. Stephen Sadian with Kathy Flesh. I mean, so, those last two films are actually early 80s, but which is really the last tide of that. I mean, I think, nowadays, you know, I don't think people, you know, I've, you know, there's been kind of people flirting with that, like, Catherine Brûlé, who's a French filmmaker. But it's kind of, there's a whole classist thing going on though, because like, when she has explicit stuff in her films, it's an art film. Because she's French and academics love her. Guys like Damiano were working class. You know, he's a working class hairdresser from Brooklyn. Uh-huh. So it's porn.
Yeah.
I mean, even though it's, you know, Devil Mrs. Jones is basically, it's like a Ingmar Bergman made a film with hardcore sex in it. I mean, it's like a Bergman film, and it's, and I think it's that good. And, but, you know, so it's, you know, you get kind of an interesting peek, I think, with just fringe cinema in general, how much of it's kind of more class-based, you know.
Whatever happened to Bill Osco? Remember him?
Oh, my God. That's a name. Bill Osco. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. It's funny because he was on that tide from the beginning, because Mona was like the first X-rated film that was legal.
Everyone thinks of Deep Throat, of course, because of its popularity and the fact that, you know, no regular people were going to see X-rated films. But I remember because I saw Mona in a movie. I mean, I was like, you know, I was in film school, you know, whatever. I mean, but I remember seeing that and Bill. The Bill Osco film, Mona, which they even had a campaign for that. Mona has word of mouth.
Oh.
And nobody else, nobody seems to know what it's about, but you could look into it. But you know, and that's how I was introduced to Bill Osco, who later did Flesh Gordon, didn't he?
He did indeed, which is, that one's a weird one, because that one, it was always rumored that it was originally, like, X-rated, like, hardcore triple X-rated, not just, like, Midnight Cowboy X-rated, mm-hmm. But, like, the only print that's ever surfaced is R. So it's probably, like, a hard R, but there's no, like, there's no porn shots in it, or, I mean, there's nothing explicit, but it does have Candy Samples, who, of course, was a popular, adult actress.
That's right, yes. Yeah, Candy Samples.
Right, and she's, of course, she's great. It's, so who knows? It's kind of like I don't know if it's like an urban legend at this point. I've read some places where they say that the X cut of it was like confiscated and destroyed, which I kind of find that hard to believe, because by the time that came out, I mean, Porn Chic was pretty established. But, so who knows?
Who was Mona? What happened? What was her name? I forgot.
Oh.
Of course, today, I mean, you know, everything is on the International Movie Database. Everything is there, even porn stuff. So I guess we could look them up, Bill Osco in there. But I forgot her name. I think she was. I only remember her in like one or two other movies.
I was about to say I can't remember her name, but it seemed like it was an actress. Yeah, who did?
Yeah, we'll have to find her and look through that, because this was the only show that acknowledged. In broadcasting, that Rene Bond had died.
Right, the great.
Nobody knew. No one knew Rene Bond. Well,
everyone should know Rene Bond.
Yeah.
Not just for, you know, adult stuff. She's a great sexploitation actress, and just she had a great quality to her. Yeah.
So many people, and this is what there are so many treasures inside a lot of these terrible packages, and we only know of, well, not we, but I mean the general public gets to know the actors and actresses who might have been in some of them, and only know them because they went on to be bigger and more mainstream performers. But there's still plenty of them who were great in there, who didn't make it. You could just look at the resumes of a lot of gigantic actors, and you see them going back, starting off in crap. I mean, I use that term with such, you know,
right?
Yeah. I embrace the word crap with. by the way, you've given me a great idea for a book, because I'm always writing down. I'm eventually going to have. I'm trying to come up with a book of book titles that I'll never write, because I love titles.
Oh yeah,
and you've contributed to that. On this show, so I'm going to write a book called "A Good Time with Mr. Hand."
That's why I'm here. Yeah. To inspire the muse
once again. Terrific. So today, who do you think? No, like the guy who did the vampire strippers.
Strippers.
Who is that?
The zombie strippers.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry. I keep saying vampire strippers. Yeah. I don't know the difference between one or the other. They're both undead. Undead. There's a phrase that doesn't even work. Who was he? Or her? Or
I, I can't remember. I saw that film too, but, to be honest, it was all right, but I didn't write about it. And if I don't write about something, it's harder for me to remember, but also, it didn't stick with me. I mean, it was okay, but, you know, it was terrible, wasn't great.
Now that there are no more or less and less, if there's any, you know, drive-ins, the whole idea of making, you know, the drive-in movie, which were always what, right? The C, D, and E movies.
Right.
The kind of things that that paid the rent for, like, Linnea Quigley and people like that. There's now that this, where are these people go? Or are there any more new people? Or where does that whole genre go?
It goes digital. It goes DVD, Blu-ray, internet. You know, Hulu, Netflix. I mean, because realistically, even by the 80s, drive-ins were kind of already starting to wane. It's like my local drive-ins, at that point, by the time I was a kid, were playing, you know, the mainstream stuff that was kind of a couple of months old.
Right.
You know, like you go see Superman 2 or Fledged or something like that. Really playing the B-movies quite as much. But so the VHS market, that's, you know, that's how I got familiar with people like Linnea Quigley, who is awesome, and I know we both love her.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I wrote her first line ever in a movie.
I know, which is incredible.
Remember? Yeah, I know.
That is so cool.
And it's funny, because she'll never remember me, and she might. Anyway, here's the deal. The deal is, so today, how is it, what do you write about today if you're writing about the things you write about? You're not going to regular mainstream, you're not sitting there writing reviews of Twilight and Twilight Tonight and Twilight 2 and Dawn of Twilight. And I went to, you know, in a bookstore, it's amazing how on the paperback books level, there's just like everything. There's this whole section of one title, one word title books, and they're all those type of books. I don't know how they get any. How do they get stories? Twilight, Passion, Twisted. You know, what goes on with the? They're not going to make movies out of all those, but that's a whole genre in itself. What do you write about now?
Well, actually, most recently, I'm working on a review currently of the 1978 film Ashanti, which was like a big budget Hollywood film that bombed like a big dog, but had an all-star cast: Michael Caine, Beverly Johnson, Rex Harrison, Omar Sharif, Peter Ustinov, oh, and William Holden. So
1978. So you're still finding movies that are becoming classics.
I would call it a classic.
What do we call them? I know, underground. I mean, some movies take like 10, 20 years to become popular again. And then now that we have DVDs and Netflix and all that stuff, I mean, there's ways we can see these things. But why that one?
Well, that one was actually sent. I mean, this is something I'm working on for Dangerous Minds. And the thing sometimes when you freelance is you get sent.
Well, why that one? Here's a movie that was a big budget movie. It was a bomb, but you're finding something culturally enticing about it, or what? Or is it just writing about how bad it is? I don't understand.
Well, no. Ashanti's interesting because it's sort of a beautiful failure. I mean, it's well shot. There's some good acting. You know, it's about the slave trade, you know, and how it was still going on. Well, it's still going on today here in 2013, which horrifying game, but so there's some interesting things about it. I mean, sometimes you get sent things to review that you normally wouldn't pick,
right?
Either, but I think Ashanti, it's interesting. It'll be a fun thing to write about, and I hope everyone enjoys reading it when it's done.
So how do they pick these things, though? I mean, how?
Well, with film. And the cool thing about being a film writer is that there's so many different spectrums, and it's not always going to be just like low budget stuff. It's sometimes, you know, you'll have like the golden turkey kind of quality with the Hollywood films that didn't quite make it, like Ashanti. You know, and that's sort of a fascinating thing that a lot of people don't write about and don't cover. And that's always to me an attractive thing. And, you know, what is this area that's unexplored?
Why do you think, and maybe you have no opinion, or maybe you don't care, maybe you don't want to say anything about it, but I liked the way Roger Ebert wrote. I've read a lot of his, you know, I've gone to, if I want to know about a movie on a, you know, on more on a deeper level, I know that he always, you know, looked at movies in a literary respect, but ultimately, he is when he died, him and Siskel were being given credit for writing, and they were writers. People knew them from television, but they were writers for newspapers, for movies. Do you think they were, to coin the phrase now, why do you think people consider them such game changers in terms of writing about films?
As far as being a pair, I think what made them game changers, I mean, the TV show helped, of course,
yeah.
But also, I think they were significantly less obnoxious.
Well, they didn't write together.
Because, like, Rex Reed is obnoxious, Gene Shalit, obnoxious, you know.
But, Yeah, but when they didn't write together. I mean, the fact that they had chemistry and they had a show and it became popular because people went to movies, but they wrote separately. And if you read their reviews separately, you have the writer, and it's not a lot like. I mean, it's a different. It's just the words of the writer. It's not listening to the writer speak, and yet people say that they were. What about those reviews? Do you think changed the way film reviews were done? Or maybe they weren't. Do you think they weren't? Do you think that's just a big bunch of hot air?
I don't know if they were game changers. I do think Ebert, and I was so sad when he passed, because I think he was an incredible film writer. I mean, he was a guy where, even when I disagreed with him, which sometimes was a lot on some things, I respected him. You know, it's like he could back up his how he viewed it, you know, with a lot of intelligence and verve. And plus, he wrote Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which is one of the greatest films ever.
That's right. I forgot about that. Yes, a lot of people didn't know. I love that. One of the greatest films ever.
It is. Film is like heaven.
I loved it. I loved it. I saw it in the movies. We had all the guys and people in my generation went to see Russ Meyer. That was the peak of Russ Meyer, who I know you could probably write a book about, Russ.
Oh, God, I love Russ. Absolutely love Russ Meyer.
When are they going to do a Russ Meyer? They should do a Russ Meyer, or maybe it's not as interesting as Johnny Depp doing Ed Wood.
Oh, God, there'd be a lot of boobs in that movie. I don't know if I'll even want to have that much.
Russ.
A lot of nudity, but Russ was, I mean, but he, seriously, I mean, I think he doesn't get enough credit, at least in, I think in other countries he's gotten kind of more respect critically, but over here I think people are just like, oh, big boobs, and kind of write them off. But Meyer's films, the way they were composed, I mean, even some of the more fluffy stuff, were just brilliant. Like his lighting, color, some of the best editing I've ever seen in film has been in Russ Meyer movies.
Hmm.
He's a fantastic editor.
And the big movie he did was the one that was supposed to put him over the top. Because I know that, because Wolfman was in this movie. What was the one? It was about the book that was the porno book?
Oh, The 7 Minutes.
The 7 Minutes. They gave him a real movie. They took that book, which was a gigantic seller, and he did the movie. And yet that, I don't know, did that do anything, any business at all? Or was it?
No, that actually killed his contract.
Wow.
You know, because he was, like, I think, signed up to do multiple movies. And Beyond did pretty good. Got money. And The 7 Minutes, it was a bomb.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bomb,
yeah.
And it kind of got him out of that contract. But which is good, because it freed him later on to do stuff like Super Vixens and Up, which are completely gone. So they are out, like, from Mars, but they're wonderful.
Well, at the end of Ed Wood, they give a little bit of biography about what happened to him, and it seems to me. Although, I mean, it's just a movie, so they couldn't go on and on and on, but there was it got more dramatic and sad and prosaic after he realized that the one they'd remember him by, and who knows if he even said that, right? There was Plan 9, you know, in the movie, in the Ed Wood movie, where they show him, you know, when going to the premiere there.
Right.
But after that, they talk about what happened to him. Do you know much about, did you ever read anything or write any stuff about him after that? Because things got weird, didn't they?
Yeah, I haven't written about Ed Wood yet, but there's a really great book on him called Nightmare of Ecstasy.
Okay.
By Rudolph Gray.
Okay.
I believe is his name. Great book. But no, Ed, it was very sad. I mean, he basically just had a lot of problems with alcoholism and just kind of died in poverty. And that's, yeah, but I always felt bad for Ed Wood anyways, because as much as people rag on his films, I mean, they're compelling. His dialogue isn't like anything else. His writing, I mean, some of the way that he phrased things, I mean, you know it's an Ed Wood film, you know? It's I'd much rather see an Ed Wood film than a Michael Bay film, so.
How on earth couldn't even a film as bad as Plan 9 or any other one, how could it not make money? Because what did they spend on that? can't have anything on it. I mean, and can people do that today, but they do it with their home programs and they use it with software and stuff like that? What about the, is there a generation of filmmakers that are using, I mean, there are, isn't there a generation of filmmakers who are doing films on videos and stuff and then putting them on YouTube or what have you and trying to work their way through? Isn't that isn't that the underground now?
Absolutely. What's interesting is, like, the good thing about that is that it's kind of made everything more democratic, which is awesome. But the other side of that is there's such a glut. You really, you know, I mean, I'm a believer that the cream will rise, but I mean, you do have to sift through so much material, and that's I think it'll even out in the end. But right now, it's, you know, it's intense how much material is out there.
They should. Maybe they need a better categorizing system on YouTube, you know, so that people could just go to various places, like, you know, indie films, and then you would just go and you wouldn't have to sift through so much because they would have certain standards, like, well, it's got to be whatever, a short, it's a half hour. I don't even know what qualifies. What qualifies as a short, or what is a feature? It's got to be over 60 minutes. I know novellas and novels and stuff, but how do you do that with movies?
With movies, generally, features tend to be 70 at the minimum. More, you tend to see more like 90 minutes to 120. Shorts are generally anywhere from like a minute, I'd say, to like 60.
Oh, to 60. Okay.
To 60 or 70. I don't know if that's a hard fact. It's just my guess.
If you were to pick you, Heather Drain, who knows and deals with all of this, let's just call it other stuff, this outside of the periphery of commercial stuff, if you were to pick last year's most, even, I mean, a popular film that was the best, that would kind of, like, well, that would be good even if you're like, you know, if you're an underground type or a off the beaten track a movie person or whatever, what movie that actually made it and was successful last year would get the Heather Drain best picture of the year?
Oh.
I don't know what you saw. I don't know what you saw, but you certainly must have heard and read enough about all the major movies. Which one would you have checked off as, like, that's great. That you would just go, that's, I don't care about anything or anybody. That's just great.
The last really big budget mainstream film I felt like that about is actually probably about 2 or 3 years old now.
Okay. Well, it's okay then. If we had to go that far back, well, what? Which?
The Watchmen, like, which was based on the Alan Moore graphic novel. It's one of my favorite films ever.
Did that really do well?
I think it's a decent.
Okay.
It's a decent.
But it was a big budget. Yeah. I don't know the original source. Or the that's a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
You bring up a whole new idea, because the other day I was telling my son, when we were out looking at, we're in a bookstore, and we went past graphic novels, and I said, you know, because I was telling him about, regular comic books, which he'll never see, because, you know, if you're 20, I don't know, you know, if your regular comic books weren't in your on your itinerary, but I told him about these graphic novels, and he didn't realize that there were some darn good movies that have come from graphic novels, and they always seem to have a certain feel to them. I happen to, see if you agree with me, I love A History of Violence. You know the movie?
Right, yeah, no, Viggo Mortensen.
Yeah.
I think that was that Cronenberg?
Yes, yes. That has, I don't know why, maybe because it has all the elements that I'd ever want in a movie, has become certainly one of the top 10 movies of all time for me. I mean, I love that movie. And it's funny because I found out, oh, geez, that was a graphic novel? That wasn't even like a book or anything? It has such depth. Do graphic novels wow. I mean, they're like literature.
Oh, absolutely. There's a whole world. I think most people just assume comic books are just like you know,
yeah,
bam, smash, you know, stuff. But there's actually, you know, quite a few ones that are really well written and complex. And anything Alan Moore did is certainly great. But like Daniel Klaus, Ghost World, was his comic, and they did a film based on that with Thora Birch and Scarlett Johansson and Steve Buscemi, and that film's great.
Road to Perdition, I still think, is terrific. That was a graphic novel.
I've heard it's really good.
And it's a great film because it has depth. And when you watch it, when I watched it, I went, wow, I had no idea we would go. I didn't know what was going on here. And I think that, tell me if I'm wrong or not seeing this the same way, the reinvention of Batman, which I still don't understand. I mean, it's like as soon as one series is over, they reboot it again. But wasn't it rebooted with this Dark Knight stuff based on the fact that they changed it into a graphic novel and took it away from its comic roots?
Well, the thing, my understanding, because I'll be the first to tell you, I love comic books, but the ones I kind of know about are more alternative and not so much the superhero stuff, other than Watchmen. But I think the comics, actually, Batman had been pretty dark, and had been dark for a while. I think the Christopher Nolan films were kind of reflecting what had been going on for quite a bit of time with the comics.
But they'd become kind of, yes, I think you're probably right, but I mean, they had become more popular as graphic novels, because, boy, the Batman that I grew up with, the Bob Kane Batman, the original Batman,
right,
was still, you know, so it was still, it was not dark.
No, it was
not dark. They made, you know, even though they, you know, he's a perfect character to make into that. And then a lot of, now Twilight was a book, and all the, what do you call, the Harry Potter stuff was books and everything. What other, Watchmen was one that, you're saying that it translated great from the graphic novel?
I think so. I mean, it was very faithful. There's only one thing that they really changed, but it was a change that worked for the film, which I won't say because I don't want to spoil it for anybody who's seen it. I think the film's impeccable. It hits me on a certain sort of emotional level.
So it probably has depth. It's probably...
It absolutely has depth.
Yeah. I tell people who don't understand, haven't studied film or aren't, you know, into literature and stuff like that, I tell people who are just regular, I hate to say regular, I mean, I'm not, you know, trying to categorize everybody, not trying to reduce everybody to a cultural stereotype, but the average, let's say average moviegoer, so I try to explain to them that lots of times they like movies because they are good and they have been. They have been cared for in a very adult and academic fashion. That's why they like them. It's not just, the star or the thing or the stuff. But they're not aware of things that touch them and things that are going on in various layers as they go on in books. So I think you just said that with The Watchmen, which is like, this is a novel, a graphic novel, but has depth. Which means is, you know, that it's rich with the metaphor, with allegory, with character, with stuff that people just take for granted.
Yeah.
And the average person is struck. It does get to people. They just don't know how to explain it or understand it in an academic sense. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is people get babied by I think Hollywood, and just like, okay. Here, it's almost like a laugh track thing, where it's like, okay, something sad's happened. Here, cue up the emotional swell of music and the dramatics, and, you know, and it's just disrespectful to me. It's like, you should respect your audience, and sometimes that means giving them something that maybe doesn't have an easy answer. Maybe black isn't always going to be black. Maybe white's not always going to be white. That's one of the reasons I love, say, John Cassavetes. I think Cassavetes was a filmmaker that never gave me easy answers, but life often doesn't give you easy answers. So to me, it just showed that he loves you because he respects you enough and treats you like an intelligent, you know, thinking being.
Yes, yes. Did an entire show on Cassavetes when he died because he was the classic example of how to game the system. You want to make the kind of movies you want to make, then make the movies they want to see. And he was fortunate enough to do that for a decent paycheck. And then he took all his money, you know, and made the movies he wanted to make, because he would not have been able to make them.
Oh, no.
You know?
No. He was definitely a working class artist, you know?
And it's what are you excited? What's the buzz? What are you excited to see that's coming up? I'm seeing, you know, I can't believe they made, Iron Man 3? I'm like, how is this the most, if I had to make a bet, you know, a decade ago, and they said, what comic strip character that you remember growing up, you think is going to be like, just like mega hit? Boy, I'm telling you, that would have been on the bottom of my list. That the whole Iron Man thing. What's that all about? Can you hear
people love a fun action film. To the credit, I haven't seen the Iron Man movies. I did see the Avengers, which of course has the Iron Man character in it. But it was fun. It was a well-made kind of popcorn comic book film. I love seeing Robert Downey Jr. get work. Because I do think he's great.
You know, it's one thing to say like that, and I agree with you, because I saw one, I didn't like two as much, but I mean, I enjoyed it, and I said, yes, it's well made, and they put it together well, but you know, we're talking about him, he just came off an international tour for 3, it's already made like $17 billion, you know, it's like outgrossing the gross national product of some countries. Why? I don't get it. I guess that is phenomena when you really can't put your finger on it.
Yeah. I do think films are way too expensive. I mean, some of the budgets on these films, I'm just like, you could feed a third world nation, you know.
But that's
half
budget.
Of that budget.
But look what they're making. I mean, if you put all the money together, a profit together of those 3, forget about the Avengers, which was, by the way, the biggest moneymaker last year. Anyway.
Right, yeah. But it made like 110 million.
Yeah, 110. But you take those 3 Iron Man movie profits, and you're like, wow, that is like incredible. And that's the one I can't. That is phenomenal to me, because I don't get that the way I get some other things. And what about the rebooted Star Trek? I didn't think they were going to make. They made another one, you know.
Oh yeah, no. There's a lot of buzz about that.
Yeah,
I still haven't seen the first one. I heard good things about it. I mean, I'm still at a point right now where I really don't want to see remakes or reboots right now. I mean, and I've heard it's good, and I'll probably eventually give it a shot. I love the original Star Trek. I love Star Trek Next Generation. But, you know, the whole, to me, it's just like, make things that you're inspired by. Don't remake something.
Well,
make something that's your inspired. Remaking something is just regurgitation. You know?
Well, they get, well, the money, and you know this, I don't have to tell everyone else something you and I both know, and that is that they're pitching a known what producers and money investors are saying, like, these are known properties. In other words, if they're going to reboot Star Trek, you know that you have an instant audience. If you do it well, you know you're going to get the loyalty of all the people who liked all the other Star Trek stuff. I mean, you and I talking about, you know, you said, yeah, I'd like to see another, you come out with another Dracula, you'll go see it. You know, it's like, hey, let's see what that's all about. See, there are these built-in audience, so they keep doing these things over and over again. And of course, that's what sequels are. I mean, Iron Man 2 and Iron Man 3 can't be much different than Iron Man. Right? I mean, yeah, what are we talking about here? You know?
Right.
But they instantaneously get the people who want to see what Iron Man's going to do now. And they didn't do it. It's funny, because look at the ones that didn't make it. The Fantastic Four couldn't go more than like 2 movies.
Well, I saw the first one. It wasn't really that great, though. I mean, I do think what's probably given something like the advantage is that it is really well made. I mean, there's nothing I could think of to really complain about it.
Right, but it comes down
to it.
It just all comes down to money. See, it all comes down to money, which is what makes what you do and what you write about so exceptional, because there are so many things that are made under the radar that are made with little money that have been that people need to catch up seeing, even, you know, in any way they can, because they've missed it, instead of seeing all these reboots and CGI multi-billion dollar extravaganzas like you're doing. Like you find a movie like Ashanti, that would be great for people to go, you know, read what you wrote and then see it and find out if there's any particular value. Great, it might not be the greatest picture they ever saw or what have you, but there's value, like you said, in some of these things that you just have to sit through these things to find them, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the beauty about anything expressive, like art in general, whether it's trash art or pie art or whatever, is that it's subjective. I mean, one person's trash is another one's treasure. It's, right. You know, one thing I try to do is be, you know, objective and capture the language of whatever film I'm watching. But also to give it a fair shake, because I think there are some critics that just live to kind of tear things down or overanalyze, and I think it's important not to do that. I don't care for that style personally.
Okay, let's talk about what you're writing now in the last 7 minutes we have here. I love, isn't it great how quickly this goes? Because
oh my god, then we just get started.
Unbelievable, isn't it great? Yeah, we have to try to stay in touch more and tell me more stuff, and then give me more stuff that I could promote and even if you can't be on that much, we should stay in touch more and see what's
Absolutely.
Going on. But tell us what. Tell about these books. Go through these books again. What are you working on book wise? Because I want to. When you get some books out here, we want to try to sell some books. We want to get some people excited.
Thank you. The first one is tentatively, because of course these things can change when you're working on them.
Yeah.
But it's tentatively titled Radio Monto, and it's my fringe culture compendium covering the great directors, films, and musicians that have been kind of overlooked, and I'm here to kind of bring them to the surface and give them a new sense of appreciation and exposure.
Good. That one's but that's the second one. You said there were two, because the other one you moved away from for a while?
No. Mondo is the one I've been working on.
Oh, Mondo's
on.
The one
you're
working. Okay.
I'm taking a little bit of a hiatus from it. I mean, I'm still working on it in bits and pieces, but the other one is a different type of compendium of sorts. It's kind of a re-examining of vampires in cinema.
A re-examining? I'd like to know about that, huh? Re-examining vampires.
Well, especially because my whole approach to writing in general is kind of bridging two worlds of, like, because most film books are either going to be academic, which are, and, you know, necessary, but usually kind of really dry, and, you know, the average film lover is going to be a little intimidated sometimes by some of those books, because they're like, oh, that's too wordy, or it's too, you know, kind of pretentious or whatever. And then you have, like, the fan kind of style writing, which is great too, but I try to bridge those two worlds together. Like, academic, but still, like, a lot of love, a lot of warmth, you know. I think great writing should always have, like, a nervous system to it. You can feel it. It's, with vampire cinema, I mean, there's been a lot of good books written about it, but they tend to be more aimed either towards academics or just horror fans. And I want to do something that kind of can appeal to, like, a professor at a university and a 14-year-old vampire fan, but also just, like, the average person. And get them interested and excited about it too, and you know, educate them as well.
I like your stuff because it has that quality that I just cannot capture. Because I just do things and think a different way. But when I read Mondo, Heather, that's where everybody should be going to Mondo, Heather, get on that blog. It's just, it's very bright. There's some, and I don't know another word I can't find for it. It's not. You know, it's bright. You could write about the most terrible thing, and then it's bright. There's some kind of goodness in all of it. And you write about a lot of things that are, let's face it, they're really down there. They're really down and dirty stuff. I don't mean dirty, dirty. I mean, you know, they're raw. you have a great eye and ear for, but you have a great ear for brightness. So I don't want to turn anybody off by thinking we're talking about all this stuff. And you're like, oh, I want to go to Mondo Heather and read about all this junk. But believe me, if anybody, even if it is junk, Heather has a very unique way of making it bright and readable and friendly. And that's a tough, talking about film, like you said, you know, it can become a little bit more too academic and intellectual, but you have a way of making it bright and getting the same points across and your own points across. I think that's great. That's just one of the reasons I always love what you write.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah.
And
it coming from a good writer like yourself, I mean, I don't think there's anybody in the world like you, which is beautiful.
Well, we all got to try to be unique, but even then, you know, it's like I admire certain things that other people can do and you know, that I don't do or what have you. So, Heather, here's what we're going to do now because we got to close this out. I'm going to thank the living daylights out of you again for letting me chase you around the cyberspace to get you going and make sure you're well and everything so that you're here. And I, you know, I would love to have you on once a month to just be talking about various, you know, things that you might want to talk about and that you're writing about and stuff. So let's see if we could do, I know it's difficult, but let's see what we could do.
Okay.
All right. And in the meantime, Mondo Heather, Dangerous Minds is the name of the online magazine.
Yes. Dangerousminds.net. And I'm also in the most recent issue of a great, zine called Lunch Meat.
Lunch Meat. Said,
yes.
I love it. Right.
And dedicated to all things VHS, kind of examining the VHS era of film and the different aspects of it. And you can learn more about that at lunchmeatvhs.com.
Okay. So there you go, lunchmeatvhs.com. And and if you forget any of these or you didn't write them down, Heather Drain. And just, I'm sure a Google search comes up with tons of stuff from you. Hey, you know, say hello to your hubby and keep up the good work. Stay healthy and everything. And for gosh sakes, stay in touch, dear.
Will do. Thank you, Frank.
I know you'll have no trouble staying beautiful because you're just beautiful, period.
Oh, my goodness.
She's the one. Okay. Good night, dear.
Good night.
We shall talk.
Thank you, Frank.
You're welcome, dear. Bye.
Bye.
Heather Drain. Bye-whoop. And that was my heart. I really dig Heather. She is like so incredibly fun and a really great writer. Lunchmeatvhs.com. Look for Heather Drain's stuff there. Dangerousminds.net, which is a magazine online. And I want to remind everybody that the new Four Culture, speaking of me, the new FourCulture.com. FourCulture.com, the new one is out. And I'm in there, as I always am, if you want to hear some of that stuff. You know?
That's Scatola over there. You know what I mean?
That's what they say. They go, Four Culture, that's Scatola over there. We got a lot of fun stuff happening there. So if you want to read the adventures of me, I don't know what to call it. I have no idea what I'm doing half the time. But that's what makes it all that much more exciting. Just improvising my way through it all. We'll be back next time. Go to the website. Go to blogspot.com during the week and watch my Facebook page for what will be coming up. We will figure that out sooner or later in terms of who's going to be on next time. We will be here again. Don't forget to go to the blog. Also, find out how you could be listening on your Android, your iPhone, your Blueberry, Blackberry, and Kenberry. Remember Kenberry? Should have mentioned that with Heather. Anyway, good night, Mrs. Ernstweil, wherever you are. Go buy my books, License to Skill at Amazon. Molotov Memoirs at blurb.com. And that's enough for that. I'll leave you now. I got nothing more to say.